French expat Tristan Maral is the wealthy, urbane heir to a world-renowned collection of art and an insatiable voyeur enamored with Karen Miller, a 15-year-old girl from a working-class family in San Francisco. Deciding he must rescue Karen from her unhappy circumstances, Tristan kidnaps her and stages her death to mask his true crime. Years later, Karen is now Giselle, and the pair lead an opulent life in idyllic and rarefied Devon, Washington. But when Nicola, Giselle's young daughter, stumbles upon a secret cache of paintings, all nudes of Giselle, Tristan's carefully constructed world begins to crumble. As Nicola grapples with the tragedy that follows, she crosses paths with Amanda Miller, who comes to Devon to investigate the portrait's uncanny resemblance to her long-lost sister. Set against a Byzantine backdrop of greed, artifice, and dangerous manipulations, In Malice Quite Close is an intoxicating debut that keeps its darkest secrets until the very last page. In Malice Quite Close by Brandy Lynn Ryder, coming from Viking in summer 2011. Your novel involves a large cast of intriguing characters, each with their own motives and stories to tell. And as the book unfolds, the multiple plot lines flow together with tremendous ease. Was it difficult to maintain so many different characters and perspectives as you wrote the book? And how much planning went into the story before you started writing?
Actually, I didn't plan it beforehand. I'm not very good at that. It began with one voice and then turned into several. My stories always spring from character, and Tristan came to me first. Once I could see through his eyes and feel his motivations and justifications for his actions, it almost wrote itself. The surrounding characters grew out of the ramifications of this one act in 1979 and its effect, obviously, on Giselle, but also her family, and then finally the direction her life takes with Tristan as she grows older and he slowly loses his hold on her. Ironically, I think of it as Giselle's story, though she's not given a point of view in the book. She's the absence at the center, searching for herself as the others seek to define her. I've always been fascinated by varying perspectives, the way that we build our reality based on our perceptions and using the facts at hand. Though these facts may be entirely illusory, in this story, each character lives in a house of cards, and as events unfold, they begin to crumble.
The book opens with the kidnapping of a 15-year-old girl, which turns out to be a pivotal setup for the rest of your novel. Was this a tough scene for you to write, particularly with kidnapping being such a sensitive subject?
I wouldn't say it was difficult because, again, Tristan was so real for me. It seemed clear what he would do and how he would do it. Because of that, I almost felt his analytical remove as I wrote it. I wasn't looking at it from her perspective, but from his. And he's a master rationalizer. So, is she seeking to escape her own bad circumstances? Is he a victimizer or a savior? I did realize going in, though, that it's a touchy subject and one I wanted to handle with delicacy. I frankly had no desire to write about a madman who keeps his victim in a box. The relationship here is one of psychological subtleties and shifts of power. This isn't to excuse the horror of it, but it's what drew me to explore it.
Your book explores an exclusive corner of the art world, involving gala painting exhibitions, mysterious studio spaces, and enlightening conversations about the role of art in our daily lives. How would you describe your own passion for art and how that fits into the world of your novel?
Ironically, the appeal of art is one of the few things I have trouble putting into words. My characters do it better than I do, but for me, the world is two-dimensional without it. My earliest memory is learning to read, and I remember the sense that my world had miraculously gone from a square to a cube, suddenly expanding and growing exponentially. I mean, there was a door I could see and walk through, but also infinite doors in my mind. And so art for me is possibility. I like to use art and the artist as a theme in my writing because I'm fascinated by that slippery line between illusion and reality and by the notion that reality is illusion. Art is, the time that life pauses and engages itself in a dialogue. The rest of the time we move through the world as if it makes sense that we're here, that the earth is spinning undetectably fast and things appear solid that are not. Art allows you to step into the enigma, I think, that is our conscious experience of being alive.
An intriguing theme that runs throughout the story is the idea of fraud and fakery, from artwork being forged to many of the characters pretending to be people they're not. Did these ideas help you in creating a larger world of mystery and deceit?
Absolutely, yes. It seemed a natural. Again, playing with the themes of art and illusion, I wanted to question the notion of what's real. So there are lies spinning from lies and illusions within illusions. I wanted to draw parallels between this rarefied world of art and within that, art fraud, art forgery, and as well as the more central mystery of who painted the nudes of Giselle, which is the core of this book, and set that against the tragic set of personal delusions in which each character is trapped. Nothing is quite what it seems to be.
A lot of your dialogue is peppered with French phrases, and sometimes even a few words spoken in Czech. And you do a terrific job of guiding readers who might not be familiar with those languages. Was it fun for you to employ different languages and cultural affectations for different characters?
Thank you. It was fun, yes. I think all writers are fascinated by language. And the idea for me was always to communicate, pull readers into the story, so I never meant to exclude anyone with it, just to root the characters in authenticity. In choosing to write about the art world at this level, I couldn't have everyone sound American. I wanted to convey the slightly nuanced pattern of speech that comes with fluency in another language. And I also think cultural background plays an important role in this book. The sensuality of French and the emphasis upon beauty in that culture are an integral part of Tristan. And the dislocation of Czech identity during the period of communist occupation plays a part in determining Mark Krycek's character. And frankly, I just like to travel vicariously through my characters.
Most of your novel is set in a small, idyllic village in Washington State. Have you spent much time in the Pacific Northwest? And how did you imagine setting this story there?
I have had the opportunity to explore it a good deal, and it crept into my imagination right away. I spent my first year of college in Oregon, and Seattle's one of my favorite cities. The Pacific Northwest has this haunting, primordial quality that I love. It's nature on a grand scale. And I love the contrast of this backdrop of breathtaking natural beauty, the wild, untamable kind, set against the very carefully cultivated refinement that exists in the little art colony of Devon. The idea of the towering evergreens looking down in bewilderment at all the trouble people create below.
Thank you, Brandy.
Growing up, my heroes were all madmen of a sort. Madness, my mother said, defined great men, just as fear defined weak ones. It seemed wise to adopt her opinion. My ancestors range from the visionary to the criminal, and I am named for a good many of them. Tristan Leander Jardin Moreau III. My surname is a dignified one in my native land, translating roughly to little dark. I've always thought of this as dusk, just before night and beyond the normalcy of day. It is where we have always existed. My obsession with beauty began in infancy. I was mesmerized by pictures, by flowers and faces, by that lovely symmetry which even the undiscriminating eye terms beautiful. Though Papa was heir to a fortune in Impressionist art, Mama was the true aesthete. I often think of the Moreau collection as hers alone. She took the paintings like lovers and knew all their stories. The gentle arthritic Renoir, the tempers of Degas, the humiliations of Lautrec, and infidelities of Monet. She wove wondrous tales around them, audacious and certainly fictive. Mama knew that the power of a painting, of any beautiful thing, is not in itself but in its afterlife, not the thing of a moment, but a perpetual quest. My own quest began with the lovely Yvette Desmarais at the age of 5. At my birthday party, I cornered her in the garden. Never was there a more satisfying game of cash-cash, or as you say, hide-and-seek. Those wide eyes, the color of ice on a gray day, and the lines of her bow-tie mouth. She began to scream, yet in later years took to writing me love letters. The paradox was instructive. Later, I exercised more discretion, but took great delight in spying upon one of our maids, Martine, at her bath. I did so guiltlessly. It was not so very different from gazing upon the creamy flush of Renoir's nudes. Only I preferred my art living. I hesitate to say I was sex-obsessed. I had not so much an unquenchable appetite as an exacting one, and as such, my cosseted world soon grew confining. I elected to spend summers with relatives in Brussels, Edinburgh, and Munich. My seasons had new names: Jennifer, Adela, Genevieve, Anna. With conscious deliberation, I collected these women, yet they were not conquests, they were studies. I soaked in their scent, memorized their outlines, colored them in. Nothing approached the ideal of my vision. And so I sought visions everywhere, following them to their end. And then came one that did not end. I called her Giselle.